welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the Medicaid expanded podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on December 3rd, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland's School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we welcome Anna Lockman. She is professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon. There she researches and teaches bioethics and public health law, intellectual property, medical technology and innovation, and patent law and policy. Big welcome, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of your fascinating recent work, there were a couple of things that I wanted to get off my desk in a lightning round. The first is our old friend, the LabMD case that we talked about, I think, just last time, Frank, after the FTC had lost on some factual issues before an ALJ. Not surprisingly, FTC, and I think you actually predicted this and even its outcome last time, Frank, FTC has given notice that they're going to appeal. And of course, it will go to the full commission on that issue. So the litigation that will not stop, that is LabMD, once again continues. Going back a couple of episodes to when we had Glenn and Holly on talking about the NPRM on the reform of the common rule, the controversies there, I think, are taking a while to die down. We had some interesting comments on Twitter, as I recall, after that episode. And there's quite a good story on NPR that you can listen to or read that highlighted some of the major controversies. It's nothing terribly surprising. It's the overregulation and the underregulation memes are both well represented. In particular, the new consent for human tissue that we kind of criticized, I think, Frank, for its broad consent type approach, that is being criticized by some researchers as needlessly creating barriers to access to important tissue for research. There are questions as to whether the multiple sites being governed by a single IRB is a dangerous under-regulation. And even some people taking a few shots at the exclusion of some of the non-physically intrusive research studies that I didn't think was particularly controversial. There are also complaints, and I think we're probably borne out by our own discussion, that it's not the easiest piece of likely regulation to read. It certainly does continue the tradition of HHS obtuseness when it comes to that. Finally, a case from California on frozen embryos, and it's styled Findlay against Lee. It's a superior court, it's a trial court opinion. But I thought it was really quite extraordinarily well done by a Judge Masullo. I was contacted by BuzzFeed to get some reaction on it. Thus, obviously, on that day, Glenn Cohen, Hank Greeley, and about 47 other health lawyers who know more about this stuff were not available. And I talked to them about the case. It's 83 pages long, and it's a quite superb primer on this issue and the various ways that you could handle it. The actual case, obviously, they went along with the pre-freezing decision by the parties that they would thaw and discard. But the way that the court goes through various types of regulation, including common law, and shows how to apply the California statutory provisions, I thought was very good. And the California statute itself is a really interesting example of how smart legislation can build effective choice architecture and really lead the parties through a truly structured sort of consent type approach. So I would recommend it to as a teaching thing, but you will have to edit some of the 83 pages down.
Well, those are such fascinating topics this week, Nick, and I would love to comment on all of them. My only initial response is I wanted to recommend, and I'll put on the show note page, an article by my former colleague, Carl Coleman at Seton Hall, called Procreative Liberty and Contemporaneous Choice, emphasizing how important it is often to have the ability for individuals to decide about how such a genetic material or other material is disposed of at the time that the decision of the disposal is made. And I did not get a chance to read the full opinion, but given your recommendation, I certainly will. The other thing that I wanted to note, just on a very practical note with respect to the NPRM, is that the HHS has extended the comment period from, I think, December 7th to January 6th. So if we have any listeners that want to weigh in on the NPRM, and the NPR story is actually a great press piece on some of the hot-button issues that people may be particularly concerned about, there are many more, then they have until January 6th to submit comments.
Professor Lockman has posted a fascinating new article that I think is coming out in Geriatrics. Is that right, Anna?
Yes, that's right.
It's called A Property Theory of Medical Innovation, and I warmly recommend it to anyone interested in FDA regulation, drug patent law, tort preemption, or even just post-industrial property theory. It really does hit an amazing number of different targets and is an extremely well-written piece. To me, there seem to be several moving parts. You have a central tenet that seems to be a refusal to accept that IP and FDA regulation are oppositional. Secondly, you identify what you call regulatory property. And you then sort of lead the reader through various scenarios where I think you're suggesting there is room for one or other of these complementary regimes, IP and FDA, to be recalibrated. I've no doubt horribly mischaracterized your work, but could you start us out slowly on what you see the issues are, why you wrote the piece, and what you're arguing?
Sure. I think the sort of the impetus behind this piece, and as you note, it's perhaps too broad, but I wanted to sort of lay out thoughts, sort of a larger scale that I've been thinking about in my work. So, as you mentioned, I teach IP, I teach patent law. I also teach courses in the health law curriculum, particularly FDA regulation. And anyone who is in this space knows that there's a lot of overlap between IP and FDA regulation, for example, Hatch-Waxman. But the way I see it, it goes beyond that, in that both systems and both sets of laws are addressing sort of core issues about how we create incentives to generate and develop information resources. And so I suggest in the piece that if we take that approach and we sort of frame it that way, contrary to sort of the standard framing where we have regulation and that impedes innovation, and we've got IP and that compensates for the costs associated with regulation, if we sort of move away from that, that standard framing, I think it can be useful in thinking about sort of core issues and how we're going to incentivize innovation. We have a lot of legal tools that we can apply to those problems, but we have to think about it in a more holistic way, in which tool is appropriate in which context.
So let me press you on a couple of the sort of example areas that you brought up that spoke to me in particular. And the first is the federal preemption of state products liability for Hatch-Waxman generics, although you note in the piece that there is a proposed rule that's going to likely end impossibility preemption coming from the FDA. Could you maybe use that as an example to explain how you see this interaction or complementary behavior of IP and FDA regulation?
Sure, absolutely. So the way I see it, that's a great example of the tort system, the federal regulatory system, and the intellectual property system working in tandem, and all of these pieces working together to create or incentives or disincentives, or really to just sort of carve the competitive landscape between innovators and follow-on developers. So generics. So we have a generic product. A generic company wants to come to market. Of course, they have intellectual property issues to deal with in the event that The drug is still on patent. They have to wait for patent expiration, or they have to file a paragraph 4 and challenge the patent. And those are issues. But in addition to that, assuming that the generic is able to overcome those patent issues, they also have to establish that they are the same or sufficiently the same as the pioneer drug. And that requires two things. One, establishing that the product itself is so-called bioequivalent to the brand name product. But in addition to sameness with respect to the composition, the labeling also has to be the same as well. So there are very strict rules about the generic label has to be, in most respects, in large part, the same as the pioneer's label. That brings us to tort liability issues. So against that background, that federal regulatory background that we have tort cases, and the plaintiff patient is alleging that the generic manufacturer that supplied the drug is liable in tort for failure to warn. In that claim, they are arguing that the generic's label contained an inadequate warning. It didn't sufficiently warn of a risk that of harm that the patient ultimately suffered as a result of taking the generic version of the drug. Now, in response, in defense, the generic manufacturer will argue, well, that claim is preempted by federal law because the federal regulatory scheme, the sameness requirement required by the FDA, does not allow me to change the label, does not allow me to change the label without the FDA's pre-approval. So therefore, it's impossible for me to comply both with federal sameness requirements and also with state-based duties to warn that would require me to change the label. So therefore, the claim is preempted and the plaintiff cannot prevail in that claim. Now, that presents a very different situation if we're talking about a brand name manufacturer in that same failure to warn case involving the same drug. In this case, however, it's the brand name version of that drug. The same situation, the plaintiff argues failure to warn. In that case, there is no preemption because the brand name manufacturer, the federal law allows the brand name manufacturer to unilaterally, without FDA approval, change the label if that change is to strengthen a warning. So that's an example where we have a very complex set of laws. We have intellectual property laws, we have federal regulatory laws, and state tort liability laws that are working together to affect the competitive landscape in the pharmaceuticals market.
That really helps give us an overview of the sense of the paper, Anna, and I really appreciate its contributions in terms of promoting the idea of coordination among these various legal regimes. And I think also I really enjoyed your papers canvassing the burgeoning IP literature, recognizing these connections, say, between reimbursement policy for pharmaceutical drugs and the patent law and other aspects of the regulatory regimes that affect them. One thing that I was wondering, just in terms of the broader context for moves like the ones that you're making, other scholars in the field, is I've been to, for a couple of years, this conference at Yale called Innovation Beyond Intellectual Property, Innovation Beyond IP. And there's a lot of buzz there about some of the ideas that you get into toward the end of the article about public funding and coordination of different legal regimes, et cetera. But it does seem to sometimes founder on the countercharge that this is socialistic, that, you know, the planning, the coordination really is just a new word for planning or central planning. And I'm wondering, do you think that that is there a way to overcome that type of pushback? For example, I mean, is there a way to sort of more characterize what your paper is doing, what others are doing, as sort of smart technocratic efforts to learn from the economics and other literatures? Or do you think there's sort of a ring of truth to some of this, the idea that there has to be a broader overarching coordination of regulatory regimes in order to optimize innovation?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and it's one that I struggle with because, frankly, I share that concern that some of the ideas sort of moving beyond IP are, in some sense, new iterations of old ideas involving command and control, and perhaps... the counter arguments against those approaches, there's some ring of truth or some validity to those counter arguments that there are some well-known problems with command and control regulation in terms of, you know, a technocratic approach. And I actually I'm quite sympathetic to that criticism. So I think that there needs to be, and I maintain that there should be a market-based set of incentives that are crafted, and we have to be able to find a way, I think, to smartly think about these problems not as a binary command and control on one set on one side versus, you know, free market, no regulation whatsoever, no government interference whatsoever. I think that there are ways to come to a more common ground on the issues. And I think the first step is to clarify where are the weaknesses in, let's say, a patent-based, market-based system. Where do we think it's doing well? Where do we think it's not doing so well as empirical matter? And then perhaps focus on areas where we can sort of commonly identify some problems and think about some tailored solution to those problems.
I do see that. And one of the things I also enjoyed about your paper, and this, my question will feature the thoughts of a couple of people whom you cite and who are also at these Innovation Beyond IP conferences, Mark Lumley and Julie Cohen. I think it's just very interesting how some thinkers, they are very aggressive in terms of pointing out the irrationalities of, say, the copyright system, or criticizing, say, its regulatory aspects as being overly burdensome to entrepreneurs. But then sometimes when it comes to trade secrecy or some other aspect of the IP regime that might be of more, they consider more legitimate, there's not the same level of criticism. And I think what I liked about your paper was it sort of, it really emphasizes the need for the holistic view, because if we just have a community of people that are like, I'm a copyright expert and here's how copyright law needs to change, that may have very little impact ultimately, or may have counterintuitive impacts if the rest of the regulatory regime, including intermediary liability and other issues, are not addressed. The second thing I want to, really this is a question, is with Julie Cohen, you quote her criticizing the fact that land has become this sort of model upon which all property theory is based, or it's excessively based on an idea of land as the property involved. She mentioned that there are alternatives like animals, environmental resources, financial instruments, etc. And one thing I'm wondering is, do you think that there's much of a future in legal reform designed to promote financialization of intellectual property? I'm thinking particularly of Andrew Lowe's proposals at MIT to promote, say, something akin to mortgage-backed securities to allow investors to take different tranches of risk associated with different stages of pharmaceutical trials. Do you think that this type of financialization is something that would be promising in the future? Or do you think that this is something that ultimately, you know, is just displacing what is ultimately the role of the state or foundations?
I actually think that's an interesting idea. I mean, obviously, as we well know, creating complicated sets of assets without a whole lot of regulation can be problematic. If it gets too complicated, then even the people who are doing it aren't quite sure what they're doing. But I actually think that that's a fascinating possibility in terms of an innovative market-based approach to perhaps de-risking projects and being able to do that in a way that encourages innovation. So I'm all in favor of those types of ideas.
Let me take you to another part of the article, and one that I spent some time on because it's an area that I'm fascinated by, and I know Frank is, and our good mutual friend Nathan Cortez has done a lot of work in. And there's a section of the paper where you deal with various diagnostic tests and also mobile health apps. And you note in the paper, although the FDA's guidance provides some much-needed clarity for the mobile health industry, I'm assuming you're sort of talking about the where they say that the areas they're definitely going to regulate in the guidance with regard to mobile health, a great deal of regulatory uncertainty persists over the agency's plan to manage the means to produce consumer-generated health information. And the crux, as you continue, of regulatory decision-making in this area involves striking a balance between enabling access to and ensuring the accuracy of the information created through use of these technologies. And the cost-benefit trade-offs resemble those that come into play within IP law. I apologize for the long quote, but I wanted to get it absolutely right because I think you really have an interesting spin on the problem that we face here. And I guess if you'd like to elaborate a little more on that, and then, of course, the dreaded "and what is your solution" question.
Well, yes. This is an example where I read a lot of IP literature and I read a lot of FDA regulation literature and sort of seeing some common themes emerge in doing that work. So in the IP field, it's all about this balance between short-term restrictions on access for current consumers or current users and concerns about that versus dynamic effects, right? Long-term incentives to innovate. So we're constantly worrying about this, for example, with pharmaceuticals, right? So we have patents on pharmaceuticals. That obviously causes access restrictions, high costs in the short term. And the counterpoint is that, well, we need to have those patent incentives because over time, in the long term, future patients will benefit from new therapies. So that's the standard attention in IP law writ large. I see very similar issues with respect to how we're going to regulate these mobile health technologies. In the short term, people want to have access to these technologies. They want to be able to do what they want to do and get the benefits from those technologies. The concern, however, is with creating incentives for in the long term for future patients and users and consumers to have information assets that actually are useful and valuable. And so the concern is about what is this information really providing to the users? How can we ensure that the information is useful and accurate and going to be something that the future consumers can use? So I see very similar sets of issues. And I think identifying those similar issues perhaps can lead us towards some solutions. But it's going to involve inevitable trade-offs, right? So where you land on this question is largely a function of which concern do you think should predominate? Should we have greater access in the short term, or should we be more concerned in the long term about what type of information assets we are able to generate and disseminate?
Ah, that's great. And I had one final topic for today, which is I really liked your article, "When Should Physicians Be Liable for Innovation?" Because both as a teacher and as a someone who does research, and as a teacher, I always find that in teaching malpractice law, the hardest thing is this balance between this concept of clinical innovation and placing it between research and, you know, clinical care and trying to explain this sort of tertium quid, you know, that's out there. As a scholar, I found it particularly interesting because you propose this fiduciary approach, which I'm also seeing in a lot of privacy law right now. For example, Jack Balkin has said that large intermediaries, rather than just imposing one-sided terms of service on people, the contract model, and rather than having an administrative law body try to impose all sorts of rules on data use, which would be something I would kind of favor, but more of an administrative model, proposing more of a fiduciary role for internet intermediaries in terms of how they use our data. And I was wondering if you could just explain to our listeners, you know, how you how your fiduciary approach would work in the context of clinical innovation and answering this question of when physicians should be liable for their innovation.
Sure. So let me just sort of provide some context in which this project I was thinking about. So as you mentioned, this is a longstanding question, a perennial question with respect to innovation by physicians in their treatment decisions, dealing with patients, trying to balance concerns about the best interest of the particular patient with also wanting to innovate and engage in sort of medical progress. So the question is, how do we deal with liability for physicians in that context? So in this case, it's important to emphasize we're talking about innovative medical procedures, interventions outside the context of a formal clinical trial. So we know that when there is a, you know, research subject in a clinical trial, there are certain, as you just mentioned in this broadcast, sets of regulations that apply to ensure that the patient or the subject is protected and the clinical research is ethical. But in this case, we're talking about a situation where the patient is in the treatment setting. And so the relationship is between a physician and the patient, and the physician has an obligation to do that which is in the best interest of that particular individual patient. And so your, you know, basic black letter law would say, well, whether it's clinical innovation or any other type of clinical procedure, that would, you know, the doctor would be bound to act with reasonable care. And that means that if the doctor does not act in sort of the customary, within the bounds of customary reasonable care standards, then that physician will be liable for harm for acting as a negligent physician. The problem I see with that, and I think I'm not alone in seeing it, is that if we say that black letter law is customary standard of care, well, then by definition, the physician's going to be held liable for engaging in any sort of innovative procedure that deviates by definition from that customary standard. So in this area, it tends to be a debate between those who favor a tort liability approach that basically says the physician will be on the hook for any harm that results, and those who take a more contractarian approach that would say that, well, this is a situation in which we have two parties that know each other, and they have an existing contractual relationship. So liabilities should be determined based on contract, right? And if the physician and the patient agree to an innovative procedure, well, then essentially the patient is going to be assuming the risk associated with that procedure. And so long as the physician does what they're supposed to do, there can be no liability. That's problematic because, as we know, in that context, we have a physician that has superior knowledge. We have a vulnerable patient. And so a contractual model is potentially problematic as well. So now, what to do about this? To me, I think a fiduciary approach is perhaps the best way to address this situation. And I think it's a natural extension of fiduciary law because the law already recognizes physicians as fiduciaries, owing fiduciary duties to their patients in other contexts. So this would be an extension of that, basically under my approach, we would scrutinize heavily the process whereby a decision is reached with respect to a clinical innovation. And if the process is good, perhaps we should give some deference to the substantive standard with respect to the substantive decision-making that is made.
We're in December now. The thoughts are turning to the end of the year, Anna. Do you dare think into 2016? Is there anything you're looking for in terms of cases that are coming up or regulatory agencies that are thinking of things, or maybe even Congress might pass some laws, although that's always less likely, I think, in the current climate.
Well, something that's been on my radar is what's happening with respect to off-label promotion of drugs and free speech, and that what's evolving with the Amarin case.
I think that's a fine example, and when we've already started chewing around a bit on Twill. And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Professor Lockman for joining us today. She can be found on Twitter at ANNALAAKMANN. Thanks for joining us, Anna.
Thank you.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. Or, given that it's the holiday season, buy some of our Twill t-shirts to exclaim your holiday health geekiness to the world. Also, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found this week?
I can be found at HealthPI, that's Health, Privacy, and Innovation, on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.